Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For anyone conscious and watching television from 1999 until 2006, the theme song for NBC's West Wing is instantly familiar. Viewers enjoyed the fast-paced visuals and dialogue, the innovative walk and talks that made what amounts to a glorified office exciting. In his new book, TV critic David Bianculli describes the show as one of the last great dramas on broadcast television that, along with HBO's Sopranos, introduced innovations still used today and kicked off what he calls the Platinum Age of Television, the title of his new book. David Bianculli has reviewed television shows for four decades for newspapers and NPR. He has written several books about television and is familiar to most NPR listeners as a Fresh Air guest host. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, David.
And I'm so glad to be here. And that, I'm already happy just listening to the theme song. So I know.
It was a fun show to prepare for. I mean, a lot of people say I must love my job, and I think, wow, you must love your job.
I do when it's good. The thing that makes it a job and the reason why it's like worth people paying you to be a TV critic is when it's bad. All I tell people is that when you come across something that's really awful on television, imagine not being able to turn it off. That's why it's a job. But the good stuff, the finding the gems and then trying to persuade people to watch them, that's what I do it for.
And there's so much good stuff now, which is, you know, you're the subtitle of your book, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It is almost too much to keep up with. But how can you complain about and being overwhelmed by quality? It's, you know, I can't, you know, I won't complain about that. I'll just try to see as much as I can and write as much as I can.
Are TV reviewers sort of like the first binge watchers of television?
Yeah, you know, it's very funny. More in the last 10 years, it's gotten to where instead of just sending out a pilot, they'll send out the first four episodes, the first six episodes, an entire season sometimes if they have it. So we have become the canary in a coal mine binge watching, but it never used to be that way. We used to see one episode before anybody else and then have to keep up with everything on the air the way civilians do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is David Bianculli. He's author of a new book entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. If you have a question or comment for David Bianculli this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm sure we're going to be talking about a lot of people's favorite shows, because that's you revolve the book around the change makers, the shows that changed how we do television and how we view television.
Yeah, I approached it two ways. One was to interview people who I thought had really made some great television over the years through the whole history of TV. And then the other part was to sort of play Darwin. And remember those things in high school textbooks, that drawing of the five stages of man?
Yeah.
Well, I try to say, what would be the five stages in each genre that I would pick and write about? And so I focused on them and then gave a full history. The one place where the title of the book is deceptive is that even though it celebrates the Platinum Age, which is the current century pretty much of TV, post-Sopranos, it's also, it covers the entire history of television to show how we got there.
Because we often talk about the golden age of television. You certainly don't ignore that. So what's the contrast? You say it kind of the Platinum Age kicks off in the 2000s with Sopranos. What's the distinction
there? Yeah, the pivot point is West Wing and Sopranos in 1999. the West Wing is sort of like the going away of what network TV used to be able to do best. And The Sopranos changed so much from the content and the subtlety to even the production schedule, you know, doing fewer episodes and having more time between seasons, an actually much more civilized way of making television than the what used to be 39 episodes a year and then cut back to 22 episodes a year for broadcast TV.
Yeah, the number of episodes is pretty striking. I binged on The Good Wife last year. I'd never watched it before. And
oh, that must have been fun.
It was shocking, though, to how many episodes they would have in a season, even then.
Yes.
Something like 26 or something.
And, you know, they did callbacks in the final year to the first season. So that really must have been a fun show to binge because you'll see, oh, look, he's standing alongside her now where the series began with her character standing alongside him as he resigned. So It was a very smart series.
Yeah, it definitely was. You have your theory about quality television evolution. You just mentioned the Darwinian theory about it. And in the introduction to your book, you use the example of shows about the prototypical single working woman to explain that evolution. Maybe do it through that to talk about what you mean by that.
Okay. Well, you know, you think about just single working women and you go all the way back, if you're really old like I am, to Eve Arden in Our Miss Brooks, a single school teacher who was trying to make it. But she was a school teacher only because she was looking for a husband. And that was the overarching drive of that series. And you jump to the 60s with Anne Marie in That Girl, Marlo Thomas. Here's a single woman in New York who's focused for a career, but she has a boyfriend, and the boyfriend is kind of prominent. And then you jump to the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd with Blair Brown, where she goes through a couple of different careers in New York and a couple of different men, and she's divorced. Mary Tyler Moore in Minneapolis was before Blair Brown and Molly Dodd, and she was defiantly single. And then Murphy Brown was just defiant, and then you jump up to Girls on HBO and Sex and the City, and you can sense, oh, there really is an evolution there that you can chart.
Is there still a storyline for a prototypical single working woman, in your opinion?
Well, has it been worn out?
Is it over?
No, I think we can keep watching. I mean, the interesting thing about Girls, which is, I guess, the most recent one, is that it has allowed its characters, and not just the central one, to be really flawed and narcissistic and not certain of any sort of direction, sort of aimless and self-obsessed, as many people in their 20s are and always have been. It's just that writers haven't always been honest enough to acknowledge it. So I think there's still more evolution to be had. By no means do I think that the television that we're watching now is the apex of what any genre can do. It's just it's clearly developing.
It was interesting that how you refer to The West Wing as sort of the last broadcast show that had such an impact that it did. And there are techniques from The West Wing that were innovative at the time and that we still see, the walk and talk thing, for instance.
Oh, yeah, the Tommy Schlamme directed thing where to get past an awful lot of exposition and to get it out of the way, this is Aaron Sorkin's way of writing. It's like, well, rather than just have people do it in a room and bounce back and forth, let's put action into the dialogue just by having them walk in this frenetic pace while everybody, all these extras are walking around them. And it must take, you know, 6, 8, 10 takes to be able to pull that off. But it works. But, you know, West Wing was just a very smart show from the very beginning. And, you know, it's through it. What it did, I think, that was so important is that it presumed that there was a sense of intelligence on behalf of the audience that a lot of broadcast TV shows these days don't do.
Why do you think that is, given the success of the, the Amazons and the Netflix of the world?
I think that broadcast TV, the mistake that it's making most often is by still really believing in and adhering to the broadcast model. I mean, broadcasting means you want to reach as many people and please as many people as possible. And when you do that, a lot of times their approach to doing that is to dumb it down to be able to appeal to the lowest common denominators. And so you don't get anything that's sophisticated or anything that's different from what was on last year. ABC, for example, right now has just tried to do all of its dramas almost as though Shonda Rhimes was writing them, even when she isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because that's what they've had success with the last few years. But you look at cable television and every single, success, breakout success from Walking Dead, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, they've all been risks. And that's what networks should be doing more of.
You wrote that The Twilight Zone, above all others, inspired more of the great innovators you interviewed for the book than any other TV show.
Yeah, that surprised me. Did it surprise you?
A little bit, but I still go back to Twilight Zone. I probably binge that. Yeah, what is it on? New Year's Eve Day or New Year's Day or something like that every year.
And yep.
I just hunker right down and do it all over again every year.
I do the same thing. I have the whole box set, but I still get suckered in.
Because it's fun to watch knowing other people are. Yeah. So, I guess I was surprised, but then again, I thought once I heard it and thought about it, I thought, well, it makes sense.
Here's the thing that I was proudest of with that, and you interview people every day, so you're going to like this, I hope, is that almost by accident, I went into that part of the book, interviewing people, without a preconceived set of TV titles that I would ask them about. So instead of asking them about Twilight Zone and All in the Family and shows that were pivotal, I thought were pivotal, I just asked them about their own viewing habits as kids and then what shows influenced them and what shows they stole from in making their own shows and kept it completely open-ended. And I did that with the first interview with Mel Brooks, and then I realized, oh, I got a lot of information there that surprised me by not, I would prepare myself for the interview in other ways, but by just allowing myself to be led in the creative aspects. And so I did that with every interview, and I loved where it led me.
So many of those people actually watched Twilight Zone as it was unfolding over the years. And I watched it when I was a kid, too.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't go back and watch it over and over and over again. But it's amazing how many famous people, I don't know if they got their start on Twilight Zone, but you see back as young as you can find them on television.
Oh, yeah. No, it's unbelievable. The episode. Oh, look, there's Robert Duvall.
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's Robert Redford. And those are just the Roberts. They're all through there.
My guest is David Biancooley. He's author of a new book. It's entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. You're familiar with David Biancooley if you're an NPR listener, of course, because he is a guest host for Fresh Air frequently, and you hear his reviews on Fresh Air. If you have a question or comment for David Biancooley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We just heard a cut from the Sopranos theme song, Woke Up This Morning by Alabama 3, along with NBC's West Wing, created by Aaron Sorkin. The HBO series Sopranos, created by producer and director David Chase, kicked off what TV critic David Bianculli calls the Platinum Age of Television. His new book is entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. David is familiar to many NPR listeners as guest host on Fresh Air, and he's still with us. Thanks again, David, for joining us.
Oh, this is so much fun. Just listening to the theme songs, it's one of the things that I talk about. I think television has made a big mistake that most of the networks that have said, we don't want to waste time on theme songs because we're worried that people will change channels. I think theme songs are terrific when the shows are good.
I agree. But the approach to theme songs has changed over time.
Yes. I mean, the theme song to Lost is like, boo. You know, that's all it is. It's like two notes, and I didn't even get close to either one of them. But you get the idea.
Right. So, you know, that whole idea of using something that you could be listening to anywhere as a theme song, it's not exactly new, but I guess, you know, if you go back to I Love Lucy, I suppose that was a song that people listened to on the radio too, or not?
No, I think that the theme song for I Love Lucy was just there on television, but it was the most popular show on television. So that was enough. You know, we've had some crossover where, like with a program like Miami Vice, a theme song will pop and, you know, become a number one hit or a top 10 hit just because of its familiarity and people want to hear it out of context. But there are many times where the show exists only on television, but it serves its purpose so well. Saint Elsewhere was a theme by Dave Grusin. I loved that theme, and one of the reasons I loved it, it meant that I was about to watch a great hour of television, and it just, you know, it was the appetizer that set up the whole meal for me.
It also felt like, as time went on, that the theme songs could become moodier and more, I don't know, but maybe that's just a reflection of television becoming moodier.
No, it's true, and you think of From Hill Street Blues, which was kind of silent and almost funereal in a way, and then you go all the way up to Breaking Bad and things like that. Yeah, it's gotten darker as TV has gotten darker.
Yeah, right.
But The Sopranos is bouncy.
Yeah, bouncy, but in a.
Bouncy, but in an ominous look behind you way. You're right. You're
which
right.
is a lot what the show is like, actually.
Yeah.
It was kind of perfect. There were an estimated 409 scripted series on broadcast cable and streaming services in 2015 compared to 2018 in just 2010. That's a lot of numbers there right now, but it's basically almost doubled. 280 is overwhelming alone, and the question has been asked, is there too much of a good thing going on? And is something or are there many things getting overlooked? What do you think?
Well, I interviewed an FX executive, John Landgraf, who presented these statistics and said, yes, there's too much TV, and it makes it harder for his new shows. And FX has done some brilliant shows over the years, including, you know, The Shield and Justified. But it's harder for them to get noticed because there are so many more out there in the field. And it's not only cable networks that are competing, but it's streaming services, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. You know, Netflix has all of a sudden glutted the market. It seems to be putting out new programming almost every week. But I don't think it's too much. I think that the cream will rise to the surface. That's my job as a TV critic, mm-hmm. is to point people towards the best of it. And I would rather, you know, have my problem be that there's too much good TV than to go back to the 1970s when the problem was you couldn't even come up with a top 10 at the end of the year without padding out the bottom.
Wow. How do you do your job with so much available fodder? I mean, literally, how do you do what you do?
Oh, you multitask on the bad stuff. You pay attention to the good stuff. If it's good enough to stop me from doing something else that I'm doing, then it passes a certain bar, and I allow it, and I'm eager to have it do that. And then the rest of it, the only secret is having no sleep and no life, and you just do what you can.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Dave and Bianculli talk about his job as a television reviewer. He has a new book out. It's entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi, hold on one second.
I've never had anybody do that on live radio before. That's funny.
Okay, Beth. Your time's running out. Beth? Oh, I guess we lost her.
That's really funny. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Sorry about that, Beth. Let's turn now to Tim in Columbus.
That was worth it. Okay.
Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Hi, Ann. Hi.
Hi there.
I was wondering where the anti-hero originated from. I mean, I'm a fan of Breaking Bad and other, I guess, anti-hero like shows. And I was just wondering if you had an area that pinpointed it, or maybe an area that influenced anti-hero. And I'll take my question off there.
Okay.
It's a great question. Thank you, Tim. I go back to shows like Wise Guy from the late 80s, early 90s, and Hill Street presented a couple of anti-heroes in terms of characters that were very, very flawed. And in comedy, you had things like Dabney Coleman in a sitcom where he played an anchor man that everybody, or a TV performer that everybody hated, and to put unlikable people at the center of television was rare as recently as the 80s, and it developed from there. But it isn't that far. That's another reason why The Sopranos is such a leap, because there's no question that Tony Soprano is a bad guy. But you sort of rooted for him anyway.
Was Archie Bunker an antihero?
Is that a tricky question?
Yeah.
It depends on whether you understood what the comedy was. If you understood that he was lovable and yet he was being made fun of, and you were supposed to violently disagree with his opinions, then he wasn't an anti-hero. But if you didn't get it and you liked what he said and you watched him for those reasons, then he was an anti-hero, but you were missing the point of the show.
Hmm. Donna in Medina, I think you have a question about maybe another possible anti-hero character.
I was just thinking how funny the topic turned to that.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear David's opinion of House. And I had heard that there was some public blowback over that character because it could have been seen as glorifying a functional drug addict.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I loved the show House, and the functional drug addict part of it was actually based on the inspiration for the show, which was Sherlock Holmes. Except Sherlock Holmes in a medical. He even had his own assistant Watson, except he was Wilson. But instead of giving him the addiction to, you know, snuff and cocaine and morphine, which Sherlock Holmes dabbled with in his stories, it was Vicodin because of a leg injury. But that was why they did that. I don't think that that's the central part of the show or a thing that really got House in any sort of trouble politically. It wasn't like when Murphy Brown, you know, decided to have a baby out of wedlock. And you have to remember, these are just fictional characters. They're just written by other people, so relax. But
but House, I mean, he was more controversial for just how he treated patients.
Yes, he had the opposite of a bedside manner. He wasn't interested in most people. He was just interested in the cases that he couldn't solve. And the funny thing about House is that I didn't even bother that it was as formulaic as it was. Because they always had to go through three or four wrong diagnoses before they figured out what it was that was actually ailing that week's patient. I always thought it would be fun to run one episode where the patient comes in with something bad and they solve it right away and just spend the rest of the hour in the break room just talking. Because there's nothing to do, but they never did that.
No, they were pretty busy people.
Yeah.
We have an email from Angel who asks, do you enjoy foreign TV shows with Netflix and Hulu? I've discovered some great shows.
Oh, yes, I do. And there was a period about 15 years ago when I served for a few years on an international jury for the Banff TV Festival and got to see the world's best TV stuff that, you know, Japanese documentaries on Hiroshima, for example, that were astounding and stuff that has never been imported to this country. But we're getting more and more and we're all the wiser for it. One of the things that I'm hoping we will get to do in the next generation of TV is to be able to watch like the BBC, not just BBC America, but watch what's on the BBC in England here and do that with other countries as well and just become truly global in terms of our TV viewership.
Black Mirror is
great show.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I just kind of, I think it suggested it to me because I like the Twilight Zone.
Uh-huh. Yes, no. And, no, you're not alone. It is the closest equivalent of the Twilight Zone we've ever had. Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories came kind of close in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
but Black Mirror, in terms of its darkness and its messages and its insistence on being about something, is the closest we've ever gotten.
And with Dark Mirror, it's about technology.
Yes, and it's on Netflix now, so that if in case any of your listeners haven't seen it yet, know that you're in for a rough ride.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most intelligent and individualistic shows out there.
Nancy in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. When you mentioned Rod Serling, he definitely had a Columbus connection because he went to Antioch and he married a woman named Carol who was from Columbus. So mm-hmm. even though he was Jewish, he would spend Christmases here with her family. And he would hang out at Larry's Bar and walk around Ohio State's campus. And somebody told me his later show, Night Gallery, he had an episode. Most of those weren't very good. But there was one called They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar.
Yes.
And a friend of mine, William Wyndham, was in it, and he said that Thurley based it on, you know, hanging out at Larry's Bar. But what I wanted to mention
before we go on to your next point, if I can say, if William Wyndham is a friend of yours, he starred in one of the most obscure yet wonderful sitcoms in TV history, My World and Welcome to It, which
James
was based
Thurber.
On the cartoons and life of James Thurber. Now, go ahead, finish your thought.
Another Columbus connection, but go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, look at this.
When you get back to Rod Serling, American Masters on PBS did a tribute to him, and it was called Submitted for Your Approval.
Yes.
And I taped it at the time, but you can get it on Amazon for people who would love to see the history and the background of Rod Serling. And it was, it aired 1995, and it was episode 10, no, I think it was season 10, episode 1, something like that. But Lee Grant narrated it, and John Frankenheimer was on it, and they talked about the evolution of television with was at Playhouse 90, and all of that. And it's just a phenomenal documentary for anybody who loves Rod Serling. Because
it was very good.
Go
ahead. Yes, I watched it and I liked it very much. There are two more Rod Serling things, since we're talking this way. If you're a fan of Rod Serling, there's something that you can get, I think, on Amazon, and it's an obscure TV thing that they will make for you one copy at a time, and it's called The Velvet Alley, and it's an old episode of a TV show written by Rod Serling for Playhouse 90. And it starred Art Carney as a TV writer. And so it was Rod Serling sort of doing a version of himself. And so that's one thing. And then I don't know if this is going to come to fruition or not, but there is talk right now of taking Twilight Zone stories and redoing them for public television as live TV, just a few of them. I really hope that that happens, but it's not officially announced yet.
We'll take a break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is David Bianculli. He's the author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you enjoyed Sunday night television in the late 1960s, chances are you were a fan of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which aired for just 2 years. Tom Smothers was famous for pushing the envelope with sketches and other elements, including its guest musical groups, including a new band called Buffalo Springfield at the time, which premiered the song For What It's Worth on the Smothers Brothers. Tom Smothers told my guest, longtime TV critic David Bianculli, that the song could have been a national anthem, at least for the times. The turbulent 60s also were reflected in the rise and ultimate demise of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. David Bianculli writes about that episode in television history in his new book entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Thanks again for joining us, David.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. And I sort of cheated with that. I wrote a separate book on the Smothers Brothers, and I interviewed Tom Smothers again for this one and got to use that for sure as one of the high points of TV variety's evolution. Because you're right, I was excited just listening to you describe it. So thanks.
You're welcome, and I'm glad you wrote a book. Now I'm going to read your other book about just the Smothers Brothers. I love the story you told about how you and your dad played chess on Sunday nights to compete for who controlled the dial on the television. This, of course, was back in the good old days when there was, if you were lucky, one TV. Maybe it was a color television.
It wasn't for me either.
It
was black and white, and it was two games out of three, and then you got to control the TV for Sunday night. And that was, you know, that was a huge deal. But no matter which one of us won, we both chose the Smothers Brothers.
Loved the show. You wrote an entire book, as you said, about the importance of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. But in your new book, the chapter is a profile of Tom Smothers.
Yes. There's two different kinds of chapters in the book. Mm-hmm. There's chapters that are looking at different genres and discussing them sort of the way Darwin would, and thinking of old TV shows as like fossils and picking through the bones. And then from the very beginning of TV history with people like Mel Brooks and Norman Lear and Carl Reiner, to recent people like Amy Schumer and Louis C.K., talking to them about the entertainment that first attracted them and influenced them. So there's and doing profiles of them. So those are the two types of elements in the book.
I kind of remember the friction that Tom Smothers caused by his insisting on what he wanted for the show and how he would go to the press. It definitely cost him the show. And we had an email from James who asked, are there particular shows that come to mind when you felt had a lot of potential, but networks, broadcast or cable canceled during their first season or didn't renew for a second? And the Smothers Brothers might have been maybe one of those.
Oh, yes. Well, absolutely. The Smothers Brothers lasted a total of 3 seasons over its little stretch. But it could have been a great show for another 3, 4, 5 years or more. It was so pivotal. And, you know, it was at the direct center of the counterculture and had the Beatles on at the end. And it was, you know, it was canceled. It had already been renewed for a season 4. And then was canceled. But when you think about one season shows that could have done so much more, I think of programs like My So-Called Life and Freaks and Geeks, just to name a couple examples of shows that did so well so early, they should have been picked up.
You wrote that every variety series or topical comedy series that has come since those 3 brief seasons of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour owes a major debt to their sacrifices. What did you mean by that?
There wasn't a program before them in primetime that made fun of presidents and of politics, that talked about the war and wanting to get out of it, that introduced, you know, Ed Sullivan introduced new rock acts, but in a very benign way. In its humor and in its positioning, Smothers Brothers was very political, and they ran one of its regulars for president, Pat Paulson, and did this Giants performance art thing that was brilliant. And now when you think about people like John Oliver and Trevor Noah and what Jon Stewart had done so brilliantly and Stephen Colbert, they all plied their trade either on cable. Bill Maher also, and Samantha Bee, either on cable or late night or both. And the Smothers Brothers were dead in the middle of primetime on broadcast television. Nobody's done that since.
Hmm. You know, Carol Burnett was another favorite of mine, but she didn't do that. She avoided, but she was more of the time before the Smothers Brothers.
Well, she was exactly the same time as the Smothers Brothers and far outlasted them, but she intentionally... she went out of her way to not do anything that was political. They were making fun of movies. They were making fun of TV. They were just having fun and leaving in all of the ad libs and the blown takes and just making it a, hey, let's put on a show. Come have fun with us. And it worked tremendously. I think anybody who watched that show remembers Tim Conway going off script like a free-range comedy chicken all the time.
The Q&A with the audience beforehand was pretty great. I didn't, you know, watching it as a kid, I didn't really understand the importance of that, but it was an amazing way to warm up, and the fact that she recorded it for television audiences was groundbreaking.
Yeah, and I didn't really understand the full evolution of that until I interviewed Carol Burnett for the book. Her producer wanted her to do it so that before she got into all the costumes and wigs that people could see who she was as Carol. But the reason why she wanted to do the Q&A is because the previous variety show on which she was a supporting character, the Gary Moore show, that's how he opened up the taping each week, but it was never filmed. It was never part of the program, but they just decided to make it the opening part of the Carol Burnett show, and it's classic.
You make the distinction in your different genres between children's programs and animation, and I wanted to talk about animation because every single one of the shows that you mentioned on it, Rocky and His Friends, The Bullwinkle Show, The Flintstones, A Charlie Brown Christmas, The Simpsons, and South Park, I've loved every single one of those programs.
And good for you, Anne.
What was it about Rocky and His Friends or the Bullwinkle Show that was so groundbreaking in its time?
Well, first of all, selfishly, they hit me just when I was born in 53. Rocky and his friends came out in 59, Bullwinkle in 61. So they were hitting me when I was a kid, and they were brilliant. They were brilliant then. They're brilliant now. And I probably have my love, not probably, I have my love of puns and bad jokes, and I'm warped because of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And it is such a great show, and it influenced so many others. And I interviewed Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, and he talked about the influence of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And it's just a wonderful show. And The Simpsons, you know, my college students now have never known a life when The Simpsons wasn't on TV.
Right. And there's a whole other generation coming up, the same thing for South Park.
Yes, exactly. And there again, and you look at what those guys did on Broadway with the Book of Mormon. You know, the future of animation and the present of animation are in very good hands.
Absolutely. And all five of those, what resonates with me as an adult now is how, of course, they could play to a child audience or an adult audience. Of course, South Park and The Simpsons, maybe not so much, but the Charlie Brown Christmas, a Charlie Brown Christmas, they play on both levels or many levels.
It was just on TV the other night. It'll be repeated once more before the holidays. It's brilliant. I don't know that it could be made, that it would be made by broadcast TV these days,
yeah,
and allow such an overt Christian message in it, a Christmas message in it. But the purity of it is what makes it so beautiful.
And speaking of music, don't you still love the music?
Oh, if I could play the piano,
yeah,
I would want to play, you know, Linus and Lucy. That is such a great song.
Ken in Delaware, you're on the air with David Bianculli. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, my entire life I've been an avid Star Trek fan, so were my parents before me.
Oh.
I wanted to ask David about, in our political climate that we, if he might speak to, about Star Trek and how it sort of appeals to the best of humanity and...
okay, we're...
Sure.
Yeah,
a few of his words broke up, but I got the gist of it, and... it's Star Trek from the very beginning made the decision that in the future that the human race would have cracked little problems like racism. And so you had people on the bridge from different ethnicities and in one case a different planet even just getting along. And it was a given. And it sounds easy to say now, but that was a bold thing to do in the mid-60s. It had famously the first interracial kiss on primetime television in one of its episodes, even though it had to be an episode that had people doing that against their will being forced by telekinetic beings from another planet, but they still wanted to get it done. But Star Trek, through all its incarnations, then to now, has pushed those same sort of ideals, which came from Gene Roddenberry, which was, you know, essentially, can't we all just get along?
Right. Let's talk about how shows end for a second. The Sopranos Cut to Black finale, widely considered
yeah,
one of television's most famous, perhaps infamous series finales. How much does that matter?
Increasingly, since The Sopranos, it matters so much now that even sitcoms that last a couple of seasons come up with an ending. And that's because a few sitcoms have come up with brilliant ones. Newhart, which harkened back to the Bob Newhart show, is one of the best finale endings of all time. I'm actually co-editing a book right now on finales, and there we have more than 70 examples. So it's pretty big. But right now, if a show ends and doesn't end with a great ending, its reputation is a little diminished, and I would say that Lost did that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it ends in a satisfying way as Breaking Bad or Justified did or The Shield, then it's like a book that you close the last page, you put the book down, you're sorry that it's over, but you're satisfied that you read the whole thing.
What did you make of the Seinfeld finale?
I was okay with it, and I was in the minority there, but I've been teaching by that time, and so I used to teach the pilot of a program, a special called the Seinfeld Chronicles, and there were a few of those before it went to the series called Seinfeld. And in the first episode of the Seinfeld Chronicles, it opened with George and Jerry arguing about whether two or three buttons in a pullover shirt was the best look. And in the final scene of the final episode, they're both in prison, and they're arguing about the exact same thing. About the shirt and the buttons again. And so the idea is, there was no growth of those characters. There was no change. There was nothing. And that was an intentional thing by Larry David. So I actually liked that. When I saw Larry David the next time after that, he asked me how in the world I got that, because it wasn't out on DVD yet. And that meant remembering it from so many years ago. It was easy for me because I'd been teaching it, so I kept it on VHS.
Who were your favorite? You profiled all kinds of people: Stephen Bochco, Kevin Spacey, Robert and Michelle King, Carol Burnett, all kinds of people. Who enlightened you about what's coming next, or is that even possible?
It is a little bit. It's a great qualifier. I think that Louis C.K. talked a lot about what was coming next, not only in terms of his own comedy, but the idea that TV auteurs would give up money to get more freedom to do more of what they wanted to do, and that was one clear direction. And Kevin Spacey, who was behind House of Cards, talked about the ability to go to these streaming sites and get what you wanted and what you believed in, more regularly. So the idea was ways for people to do more of what their vision was. I hope that's the future.
And what about the future of women in television? A lot of people were disappointed that a woman wasn't given a slot on, the late night talk show circuit. What about that?
I would be more concerned about that, except that in this last political election cycle, which was white hot, mm-hmm. and everybody was looking at what all of the satirical comics were doing, Samantha Bee was doing stuff that ranked with the best of them, mm-hmm. and still is. And as we're speaking, she returns to TV this week.
Smart.
On the Monday night, in fact, tonight. And so, I say that the future, no, women are not on an even keel on television yet, but with people like Samantha Bee and people like Lena Dunham and, others leading the way, Amy Schumer, we're doing fine.
Dave and Bianculli, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, I've loved the time. Thank you, Anne.
That's David Bianculli. You're probably familiar with him as a guest host for Fresh Air. His new book is entitled The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.